Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. And welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with best-selling novelist Greg Iles. He's back to tell us about The Bone Tree, the epic second novel in the trilogy that began with last year's Natchez Burning. And we'll hear from memoirist Felice Picano about his charming book, Nights at Rizzoli. Greg Iles is the New York Times bestselling author of thrillers, both contemporary and historical, starting with Spandau Phoenix, published in 1993, and last year's Natchez Burning, the beginning of a trilogy featuring Penn Cage, novelist, former prosecutor, and mayor of Natchez, Mississippi. In that novel, Greg dove deeply into the history of his hometown. The story continues in The Bone Tree, just out. This is a book that will keep you up late, I promise. Welcome back to The Reading Life, Greg.
Glad to be here, Susan.
Well, if readers thought Natchez Burning was epic, then The Bone Tree is no disappointment. This comes in at 804 pages.
Oh, that's just a nice, snappy read. You know that.
Now, this is the fifth novel featuring Penn Cage, the former prosecutor, the novelist, mayor of Natchez. So what is it about him that keeps you coming back to him? I mean, he's got a lot of you in him, I think.
He does, although I say Penn is much more of a Boy Scout than I ever was, I think. But when I wrote The Quiet Game, the first Penn book, it was meant to be a standalone and never a series. And it was 7 years before I returned to him. And then I think maybe another seven before I returned again, or close to that. So I think what brought me back was, you're right, he has elements of me in there. And also, Penn, while he began, is almost a Grisham sort of character, sort of an everyman attorney with a little more to offer than that, very idealistic. He's grown as the books have gone on, and I've certainly in this trilogy tested his sort of commitment to ethics and morality and those things, and especially within his own family, sort of pulled his legs out from under him and made him doubt everything he was. So in that sense, he's a good protagonist to explore, I think, the South or the issues of family.
And one of the interesting things about this particular volume is just the position to put him in. How far will he go to take care of the people he loves? How far will he go to protect his family? You know, what are his duties to his city as well? So you set a lot of traps for him in this book.
You know, the funny thing about Penn, I think what makes him different than most writers' protagonists is that, you're right, I do put him in some tough situations, but he's not and has never been a sort of a action hero or anything like that. He's really almost more of an observer and an analyzer. And you're right that in The Bone Tree, he finally does get into some pretty serious dilemmas, both moral and physical, and that's fun to do. But I like the fact that he's not a standard sort of tough guy, you know?
No, he's a demon with a cell phone and a good driver.
Just. Oh, God.
Now, the scope of this book is really panoramic. You've taken some looks at some tough, tough things in Southern history, but you expand beyond that in this book, don't you?
Yeah, and I've got to say this, you know, for those who read Natchez Burning, The Bone Tree is a bit of a digression from the A story, which is whether or not Tom Cage is guilty of killing his old African-American nurse, and if he did, why did he kill her? Was it a mercy killing, or did he kill her to keep her quiet? And it slides over into New Orleans and into somewhat of the JFK assassination. Now, I've never been a conspiracy theorist or anything, but I will say, when I was writing The Quiet Game and living actually in New Orleans around the time I was doing that, an old patient of my father's who had been a New Orleans cop who had been paid on the side by the Marcello family took me around the city, and boy, was that a tour. I went from the haunts of the old mafia where they met every morning right up into some of the offices of city officials that stunned me. And I really saw how New Orleans worked and how the reality is very different from the textbook version. And on that tour, my interest was whetted, I think, into some of the things I go into in this book. And that cop, believe it or not, who was later a detective in Natchez, had been associated with the Garrison investigation, and he had some of Jim Garrison's records from the time. And so I've had a sort of unique insight into all that stuff.
Well, were you daunted at all by taking that on? Because so many people have.
You know what? Because it was a digression, and because I wasn't approaching it like, oh, wow, here's the answer, and I'm breaking some new thing. Even though I will flat out tell you, I'll say this. I believe that if Oswald did not act alone, I think that what you'll read in the pages of The Bone Tree is not only the most likely thing to have happened, it's one of the only credible things that could have happened. And it's sad that, in a way, that Jim Garrison was in the right city when he carried on his investigation. He just investigated the wrong people, I think. But no, it didn't daunt me. It was a lot of fun. My only regret is that, as you saw reading the book, it's presented ultimately in sort of a didactic form, and it's more telling than showing. I almost would have liked to devote one novel to that, but that's not the way it worked out. So.
Well, you still could another day.
Now, well, if I uncover something new, I might do that.
Well, I love the way you tangle in Louisiana and New Orleans so much into your books. It's like we're just next door neighbors after all, right?
Well, Natchez and New Orleans really do have a lot in common. And maybe not everybody in New Orleans knows that, but if you live in Natchez, you certainly do, because when you go to New Orleans, you just feel completely at home there. And so much is left from the past. I don't want to sound so cliche, but in a way, you can be in parts of the city, and it's like it might as well still be 1850, you know, if you just look around and smell the smells and look at what you see. So I've always felt that connection to New Orleans.
Now, one of the things I love about this book is this quest for the Bone Tree, which becomes increasingly urgent. And that is such a powerful image. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about that. I mean, of course, you couldn't have called this book anything else after you invented the Bone Tree, I think.
Well, and you're right that I did invent it, but it is based on something real. And that is in the 1960s. The FBI knew that the Ku Klux Klan and an offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan had a place where they were using it to torture and in some cases kill mostly African Americans, but occasionally white people too, who sort of broke the code of the Klan. And they never found this place, and they weren't sure exactly what it was, a house, a hunting camp, a certain location. So in the sort of vagueness of the known facts about it, I found myself wanting to create something that was more organic and primal than that. And the Bone Tree allowed me to give it a longer history and tie it to the even earlier violence in our part of the country, going all the way back to the Indians and then the Civil War. Because, you know, in the territory I'm writing about, all those sorts of killings did occur, particularly during the Civil War, a lot of raiding activity and murders and things. And so the Bone Tree just became this wonderful symbol. And some of those cypress trees really are 700-800 years old down there. And so it became something that encompassed this atavistic part of human nature.
Well, it's an amazing creation. And also, you have one of those exclusive hunting preserves that everybody reads about and kind of fantasizes about. So that's fair. That's really interesting, too. So what's the movie action on all this now?
Well, the movie thing is really great. You know, when I wrote the book, and after my accident and I expanded it into three volumes, I didn't think there was a prayer in the world that it would be a feature film because it was far too long. But just by pure luck, because of True Detective and Game of Thrones and the new format of the cable series, these extended format things, suddenly Natchez Burning and the trilogy became perfect for the studios. And I started getting a lot of calls from A-list actors and producers who wanted to play the part. And Ultimately, I settled on working with two people who I'm co-producing with now. One's Tobey Maguire, who most people know of as Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And the other is David Hudgens, who was the showrunner of Friday Night Lights in its final year. And I feel like Friday Night Lights is one of the few shows that portrayed the South and small-town life in a very realistic way. And that's why I chose them. And ultimately, after a 6-network bidding war, we've arrived at, believe it or not, Amazon Studios, because they're going to be taking on Netflix in the drama arena, and they gave us a budget commensurate with True Detective or Game of Thrones and a lot of creative freedom. But the point for your listeners is our plan is to be filming in Natchez and Concordia Parish in 2016, and that is the wonderful news.
All right. That's exciting. Ah, so when are we going to get the third book?
It's supposed to come out, you know, a year to the day. Now,
that's what I thought.
The draft of the book does exist, but I have had some discussions with them. We are thinking about postponing it just a bit, mainly because really in the years just prior to and after my accident, a couple of things have happened. One, I haven't taken any sort of break. I joke and say the last vacation I had was being in a coma at University Medical Center for 8 days in 2011. And that's largely true. And I just need to stop and recharge my batteries a little. Now, I'm not saying for sure that will delay the book, but this one could come out a little later, even though it's only probably going to be half as long as the first two.
Well, okay. I guess you need a vacation.
I mean, it sounds like a best-selling novel is whining, but I kid you not. I'm one of those guys who doesn't know how to stop working, but eventually you start to burn yourself out. You know?
Well, and you know, you're smart to realize that. If you don't give yourself that break, nobody else does.
I didn't even realize it. My own agents who make their living off me were the ones who called me and said, you're going to stop, you know, for a while.
Now, I remember the first time I met you. You just knew your path was clear. I mean, at the very beginning, you said you had studied best-selling novelist, you were going to become one. So are you where you want to be now?
Well, Susan, I can still see that day that we met. You are my first real interview of any kind in my entire career. It was strange, but you're right. I can say this. I feel like writing was not something I set out to do initially. I loved music much more. But writing was certainly what I was meant to do and where my talent most lay. So finally sort of accepting that on one hand gave me resolution that had always been missing. Now, you're right to say when you get to the point I am now, what is it that keeps you going? You get on sort of a hamster wheel. You know how publishing works. You know, you're cranking out these books each year. I think for me it was nearly dying in a car accident, losing my leg and being hurt many other ways that made me realize I don't have an infinite number of books left to write. You know, the things that I want to say, I need to get busy saying them. And it takes a good while to write a novel. So I don't know how many I have left. And when I think about it that way, you sort of start to prioritize those ideas that you have left. You know, you've known so many writers. I've been lucky to have a career that's lasted as long as it has. And for a lot of writers, they don't get that chance. So I want to use the opportunity as best I can.
And what's interesting is that it's you've grown and you've grown and you've grown. You know, like this trilogy was originally going to be one book, and now it's this epic 3-volume thing that is both wide and deep. So this is maybe the book of your lifetime in a lot of ways.
It may be. And when I think of what you're saying, the one thing I want people to understand is that, you know, in writing, just like the film business or anywhere else, what the powers that be want you to do is simply redo and redo and redo whatever made money for them. And so to do what I've done and try to write across many genres and change my focus, that's probably been the biggest challenge of my career. And the most luck I've had is that people bought enough books that publishers would still pay me to do that. You know, it would have been a much safer path. It's no knock on James Lee Burke or anybody like that, but the much safer path is to take your protagonist and just stick with them over and over and over. And I never wanted to do that, you know?
Well, it's been fun to read your books all these years, let me tell you.
Well, at least it's not boring.
Never boring, never boring. And New Orleanians are going to love this one in particular. We've been talking with best-selling novelist Greg Iles, whose new page-turner is The Bone Tree. You can meet him Tuesday, May 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Greg, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's like a book ending the career right here. Let's hope it's not over.
Oh, no. Felice Picano is one of the most popular and entertaining writers at the Saints and Sinners LGBT Literary Festival. He's one of the founding members of the Violet Quill, that influential gay writers group that met in the 1980s. He's a novelist, poet, playwright, publisher, and critic, and a memoirist. His most recent book is a charming memoir, Nights at Rizzoli. Felice, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
It's such a charming book and such a beautiful book as well.
Essentially, it's the story of me as a very young writer in New York City in a period nobody's really written about before, which was the mid-1970s. And it was a cultural high point for New York City. New York City seemed to be the center of the world there for about 5 years or so. And I went to work completely by accident in what turned out to be the most glamorous bookstore art gallery in the universe. It was like a museum. It was very entertaining and very interesting. And I was hired as part-time temporary Christmas night help. You know, the lowest of the low. You can't get any more impermanent than that. But within 2 years, I was co-manager of the bookstore. And I think it was because there was a changing of the guard taking place there. The old book selling was changing to the new book selling. It was the era of the big bestsellers. Yes. You know, they were just beginning, Jaws and The Godfather and all that. And I had worked in bookstores a lot before that because my way of being a writer is to, or used to be, to work 6 months and earn money and then to write for 6 months. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do it at the same time. And so I ended up there in this marvelous place.
I think it's a terrific education for every writer working in a bookstore. I mean, I was a bookseller for 15 years, and you learn so much just from handling books all the time.
Right.
But you said you were so efficient, you kept getting promoted. So you were always turning
the curse of competency. It's really terrible. After a while, I was done with the store. My first novel was about to be published, and I couldn't get away. I mean, they kept holding on to me and holding on to me. And in fact, it wasn't until I hired my own replacement and tested her out for 2 months to make sure she would stick before I could get away. And by then, I had a best-selling novel on the New York Times paperback list.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Now, what's so charming about this book, in addition to the way it looks with the architecture of the store on the cover and this great party scene on the back.
Yeah, it's the cutest book in the world. Everybody wants to just pick it up and hug it.
But it's a story of, you know, bookstores become families, however dysfunctional. And this one was certainly no exception.
No exception. Because people had to speak at least two and usually three languages to work in the bookstore, we had this crazy, crazy, very talented group of people working there who were at least as interesting as the many, many celebrities who came in. So, for example, the woman who really started up and ran the record department for many years, Ruth Hirsch, became friendly with Igor Stravinsky, who used to come in, and Robert Kraft. And when Columbia Records started putting out his complete works in a uniform edition, Stravinsky's complete works, she did all the liner notes for them.
Oh, fantastic.
So, I mean, you know, this is an intellectual woman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there were painters there. In fact, one of the reasons I kept on getting promoted was the guy who was just above me was a painter, and he would have all of these art shows in Europe. And so he'd say, I go to Europe. gone 2 weeks, gone 3 weeks, gone 4 weeks, take over, you know. And that's how it would happen, you know.
Yeah.
So I was thrown into the front lines.
So tell us about some of those celebrity clients. It sounds like a party all the time.
It was really interesting because it was Fifth Avenue and 53rd Street. And there were all these wonderful restaurants in the area, especially Sixth Avenue and Broadway area. And they would see the beautiful windows, you know, with all the books and art and music. And they would come in, and it was, you know, it had marble floors and Venetian chandeliers. And there was more artwork on the walls than I'd ever seen outside of a museum. So it was just a wonderful place to hang out. So, for example, I remember one night, Gregory Peck, who was a regular when he was living in New Jersey, would come in, and he'd say, "Now, did you see Abba Eban, who was the ambassador of Israel to the UN? And I'd say, "Well, you know, he hasn't been in here yet, but George McGovern is here." "Oh, yeah, I know him. Let me go. Where is he? Let me go say hello, you know."
Oh, that's really nice.
You know, and then Anthony Quinn would come in, and everybody came in. Maria Callas came in. Greta Garbo used to come in.
Every
2 weeks she would come in, and the store would go absolutely dead silent as she passed by. You know, and she would go through the whole store, which is this big L from mm-hmm. one street to another. And the whole store would go silent and everybody would look at her. You know.
I bet everybody wanted to see what she would buy, too.
She was buying fashion magazines from France.
See, we always remember those things.
Yeah, I went and asked right away, "What'd you buy?" And the cashier, who had no idea who she was, right, said, "Oh, yeah, she's a very nice lady. She spends X amount of dollars every 2 weeks when the fashion magazines come in."
Wow. And you had Rose Kennedy.
Oh, and Jackie Onassis.
Yes.
Yeah, I developed personal customers because for many, many years I was really oblivious of celebrity. So as I talk about here how it took me like a half an hour to figure out who the most famous person in the universe was, Jackie Onassis, I just had no clue. I thought she was a nice lady, a photographer.
Yes.
She told me she was a photographer. I believed her.
You know. And you introduced Richard Thomas to Mick Jagger.
To Mick Jagger, yeah.
That was great.
Yeah, Mick Jagger would come in all the time because Bianca Jagger, they were living in New York then, and Bianca Jagger was a big fan of it, and she would come. Elton John would come in, and he would come in sporadically. And once the art gallery opened up, and I had to go tell the Italian woman who ran it who he was. She had no idea.
Oh.
You know, she said, "You know, who is this hippie person? You
this
know?
Hippie person?
He looks very hippie. Can I trust him?" I said, "He's got money up the kazoo, you know, to begin with."
He could buy the store.
And he had said, "You know, I just bought a chateau in the south of France, and the rooms are all empty, so let me buy some art."
Sweet.
And he ended up buying furniture that had been upholstered in France, sort of Art Deco furniture, with Dubuffet had designed all the upholstery on it. Yeah.
And Salvador Dali came as well.
Dali
right?
used to come in, a very strange man, yeah.
One would hope he would live up
to his
reputation.
He was wearing spats, right? He was wearing these handmade shoes with spats. Mm-hmm. He had this big cane, and his mustache was out 6 inches on either side of him, and hard as a rock because I touched it once.
Oh.
I don't know what he put on there, tar or what.
So, you know, at this time, you were living a kind of double life of your own. You did this rather consuming work at the bookstore that was a lot of fun, but you were also a young writer in New York.
Mm-hmm. Since I was night manager much of the time, I would close out the store and do all the books and everything, and I would end up going home at like 1 a.m. or so. Mm-hmm. And I thought I could go to sleep and get up at 10 or 9 in the morning and write in the morning before I went to work. But that never happened. So I'd be up until 6, 7 a.m. doing my writing or going out and fooling around. Because I did a huge amount of
that.
A huge amount of that. You know, just to, you know, get rid of all the excess energy.
Well, we've been talking with Felice Picano. I love his memoir, Nights at Rizzoli, and you will too. Felice, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses The Asylum, True Tales of Madness from a Life in Fashion by Simon Doonan. Tuesday, May 5th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Newcomers are always welcome. Today's guest, Greg Iles, discusses and signs The Bone Tree, Tuesday, May 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Chris Chambers, who directs the Walker Percy Center for Writing and Publishing at Loyola University, and whose new book, as Delta 88, is the featured reader in the student-run 1718 reading series, Tuesday, May 5th at 7 at the Collins Hotel, 3811 St. Charles Avenue. Sally Michelle Jackson discusses her new book, The Darkness Survives, Volume 2 in the Heilsing Cases, Tuesday, May 5th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold a general meeting on Wednesday, May 6th at 10 a.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Ann Roth, former president of the New Orleans Orchid Society, speaks on orchids then and now. Kimberly Willis Holt signs Dear Hank Williams Wednesday, May 6th at 5 at Maple Street Bookshop, part of the observance of Children's Book Week. That will continue on Saturday, May 9th. It's Independent Bookstore Day from 11:30 to 1:30, when there will be a party with children's authors. Kenny Harrison, author of the Hide and Seek Harry series, Marty Dumas, author of Jala and the Wolves, and Alex McConduit, author of Snowballs for All. Then at 1:30 Saturday, students from Big Class Writing Project will read from their work. Matt McCarthy discusses and signs The Real Doctor Will See You Shortly, A Physician's First Year, Thursday, May 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. Christophe Borny discusses and signs The Furniture Bible, Thursday, May 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, and again Saturday, May 9th from 2 to 4 at Gallier House, 1126 Royal Street. Gunter Bischoff, the Marshall Plan Professor of History and Director of Center Austria at the University of New Orleans, speaks on the aftermath of World War II in his native Austria, Thursday, May 7th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses The Golem and the Jenny by Helene Wecker, Saturday, May 9th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. And don't forget that Independent Bookstore Day is coming up, celebrated around the country on May 2nd, but because of the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, New Orleans booksellers will observe it May 9th all day long. Your indie bookstore, so vital to our local literary culture, will be offering special items only available in indie bookstores. We're lucky to have so many fine indies in New Orleans. Garden District Bookshop, Tubby and Coos Mid-City Bookshop, and Octavia Books are planning special activities, including a fun literary scavenger hunt. As part of their celebration of Independent Bookstore Day, Octavia Books hosts Irvin Mayfield signing New Orleans Jazz Playhouse, Saturday, May 9th at 3, followed by Carrie Rollwagon signing The Localist, Think Independent, Buy Local, and Reclaim the American Dream. That's at 4. And Sarah J. Maas signs A Court of Thorns and Roses at 6 o'clock. Greg Alexander, author of The Holy Mark, discusses dreams as a plot device, Tuesday, May 12th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And coming up, mark your calendar now so you can meet Todd Bowl, one of the co-founders of Little Free Libraries, and Margaret Aldrich, author of the Little Free Library book. They will appear at a Friends of Little Free Library potluck dinner, Saturday, May 16th at 6 at the Family Life Center of Aurora United Methodist Church. That's at 3300 Eaton Street in Algiers. Bring a favorite dish to share and RSVP to NOLALibrary@yahoo.com by May 14th. Come on out if you're a library steward or a user, or if you're interested in becoming one. And a shout out to University of New Orleans librarian Connie Phelps, who's been selected as the 2015 winner of the Association of College and Research Libraries Women and Gender Studies Section Career Achievement Award. The award honors significant longstanding contributions to women's studies in the field of librarianship over the course of a career. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.